The scene is mid-1700s. For those of us that live in America, this is the time that reminds us of the season when our country gained its independence from England. There's a lot of fun stories that we like to tell from that time, stories of hope and victory. But if we were to slide our view just a little bit to the east, into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, we would find ourselves in an area called the Middle Passage. There would be a boat that we would see, one of many boats that would be traveling the Middle Passage. This boat would have began its journey in England, where goods that were valuable to the people of Africa were loaded onto this boat, and then it would travel to the African coast, where the captain of this boat would trade his goods for human souls, for people. He would trade them with English slavers who had traveled the African lands to capture and enslave people. He would trade them with African people who had captured their own countrymen and people from their continent. They would take these people and they would cram them like sardines, 450 to 600 people at a time, into one boat that certainly was not large enough to carry that many people. They would be stacked on their backs, sometimes stacked on top of each other, and it didn't matter if they needed to go to the bathroom because there was none to be had. The conditions on this boat, as it now traveled across the Middle Passage on its way to the Americas, were so vile that many would die just from the travel. The stench from these ships was so terrible that you could smell a slave ship from a mile away on the open ocean. The trip would take about 100 days. If they had complications, maybe more. If people died, they would throw them in the ocean without a funeral. If people were alive and they were just carrying too much cargo, they would throw these people into the ocean. One English court referred to this as just like throwing horses into the ocean. When they finally made their way to the Americas, these people would be sold into slavery to plantation owners. They were primarily working in sugar fields, gathering sugar that would then be placed back on boats to make the way back across the Atlantic Ocean to England. This industry was so profitable for England. Much money was being made, and their tea was sweet. And it is in this background, this historical background, that William Wilberforce is born on the 24th of August, 1759.
Hey everybody, welcome to Church History for Chumps. You just heard the handsome, sultry voice of my co-host Thomas Duell, and I'm John Simon, and yeah, that was a little bit of background for our topic today, William Wilberforce. And Tommy and I kind of did this fun little trade-off where last episode I kind of took the reins. This one's all you though, dog. So I'm just here to provide color commentary.
Nice.
And I knew a little bit about William Wilberforce. I knew he was involved in abolishing the slave trade, which is, you know, shout out to him.
Yeah.
A lot of gratitude
real
there.
One.
Real one. That story you told, just, I mean, as a half black American, I can say the depictions of slavery are there's a lot there.
Yeah.
It's gruesome. I don't often use terms like generational trauma, but I do think like there is something just really it feels almost like an attack on your humanity to witness or to observe something that blatantly gruesome.
Sure. Yep.
And stories of those ships are just like a pit to the stomach, you know.
One of the things that we're going to find is that it was depictions like that being brought into the public consciousness that was massively instrumental for getting the slave trade abolished.
Yeah.
But we got a ways to go before we get there.
Well, let's get there, man.
Yeah. So this guy, William Wilberforce, was born, which, by the way, context, Wilberforce is one of my all-time favorite people in church history. He's a personal hero of mine. I've wanted to do a Wilberforce episode since we started, and so I'm really excited. So he was born in this very luxurious, wealthy family in England in 1759. Weird time to be growing up in England. I mean, tensions are high with the colonies. But for a lot of people, they were just insulated from that. They were really wealthy, and they just kind of lived insulated from all pain. And that was the world that William grew up in. It was a family that had been very wealthy for at least a century. And their family's faith tradition was connected with the Church of England, which at this time in history was just very stagnant and not vibrant at all. It was not likely, if you were living in England at this time, that if you were involved in the Church of England that you had really even a confessional Christian faith at all. It was very cultural. So when he's 9 years old, he is sent to go live with his aunt and uncle, who happened to be what we would call like evangelical Christians. They were Methodists. Ironic today. shout out our Methodist friends. But his aunt and uncle were just like beautiful Christ followers. And his mom and grandpa didn't realize that really when they sent him to go live with his family. It was actually at this time that he met really famous people like George Whitefield, the famous preacher. Also John Newton, who we're going to talk about later, the guy who penned the hymn Amazing Grace.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. He met these folks and he was just immersed in this Christian community. And at the age of 12, he converts to Christianity. When his mom finds this out, she's like, no, that's not okay. And she pulls him back home. And there's this fascinating thing that happens where Wilberforce's aunt is just begging her sister, like, just please let him stay with us. Like, he's found faith. Like, he's growing here. And his mom, who is cold, cynical, doesn't love God, says sarcastically and cynically to her sister, she says, if it be a work of grace, it cannot fail. And she's just like speaking flippantly about her son's faith, but it ends up being quite prophetic.
Yeah.
For the rest of his teenage years, his mom and his grandpa they make a concerted effort to just obliterate this Christian faith that he has. They don't do it necessarily through like re-education and just, you know, cramming him full of like enlightenment ideas. There's a little bit of that, but really they just try to like win him over to like the life of luxury again. And they just really pour it on thick in that way. So by the end of his teenage years, he puts up a good fight for a few years, but by the time he's an adult, he's just kind of like an intelligent party animal. He's like the smartest guy in your frat house, kind of. You know, the guy who is serious about his law degree, but also can throw down some cold ones kind of guy.
Yeah.
You know, that's Wilberforce at this time. So she wouldn't even let him attend the high church Anglican services anymore. So for many years, he just isn't even associated with the church at all. He grows up and he's kind of like this like shrimpy kind of guy, like isn't very big. But he has this magnetic personality. And the famous author James Boswell once witnessed Wilberforce speaking in public in the House of Commons and says, "I saw what seemed a mere shrimp mount upon the table, but as I listened, he grew and grew until the shrimp became a whale." So he's such a good speaker and public orator, he actually ends up being elected to Parliament at the age of 21, super young.
Yeah.
1780, he's elected to Parliament. And then within 3 years, he's elected to the prestigious contingency of Yorkshire County. I don't know why that's prestigious. Full disclosure, I've studied Wilberforce a lot, and I cannot wrap my mind around English government. It is so confusing to me as an American. Like, the whole parliament structure and how the prime minister plays in, and then you've got the monarchy. It's just, it's an enigma to me.
I'm familiar that the king is before the queen, and the queen is before the jack. That's about as far as I know.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's solid, brother. Yeah. I'm glad to know that. And then you got the bishop and the rook.
Okay. I'm falling behind, I think. But yeah. Yeah.
I think I just went from cards to chess. Oh, well.
That's okay.
So he also at this time becomes really close friends with a man named William Pitt, who is even more dynamic than William. And his buddy, William Pitt, becomes prime minister at the age of 24. So if you think about it, within 3 years of Wilberforce entering parliament, he is like just in the absolute thick of it. Like, he's in this powerful position, he's buddies with the prime minister, he's really on this path to probably a long life of wealth and power in parliament. He's also really likes to party, like I mentioned, and spends a lot of time just investing a lot of his energy outside of parliament into just throwing parties and like singing, and not that singing's bad, but he was just doing it to like show off. And people described him at this time as just having this quick temper and being like this spoiled, angry man.
Okay.
Then something interesting happens. In the spring of 1786, so this is, I think, 6 years after he enters Parliament, so he's 27 years old, he goes on this, like, cross-European road trip, basically. And he's riding in a carriage with this guy named Isaac Milner. Now, Isaac was actually, I believe, a former teacher of his when he was, like, a schoolboy. But Isaac was a prestigious mathematician, like superior intellect. He was also a Christian, and he had become a priest. And I'm not sure, I can't remember why they happened to like commit to like this basically year-long carriage road trip together. But he's stuck in a carriage with this confessing Christian. I believe Isaac was also a Methodist, which again is like kind of the confessional Christianity of the day.
Yeah.
And Wilberforce really liked the rhetoric and the argument, and he was just always kind of just poking at Isaac on the Christianity stuff. And Isaac told him one day, he's like, you know, he said something like, I can't keep up with you in this kind of debate and the fire throwing and all that. But if you ever want to have like a serious conversation about Christianity, I would be willing to have that with you.
Mm.
And at one point in their travels, they come across this book. I can't remember what it's called, but it was some Christian literature. And Wilberforce asked Milner, he's like, hey, what do you think about this book? And Isaac said, it's actually one of the greatest books ever written. Like,
wow.
If you want to talk about it, we could read it together. And so they do. So by the time that he gets to the end of this road trip, he is in like a full-blown spiritual crisis. He hasn't quite return to Christ yet, but he knows he needs to, and he's just really struggling. So it's in this moment that he seeks out one of the men that he met when he was a 12-year-old boy,
mm-hmm.
John Newton.
The Fig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Fig himself. John is a fascinating character in history all on his own. He was both a slave and a slave trader. He was a white man.
Wow.
Who had been like, he started working on slave ships, I think since he was like a teenager. And at one point he like got himself in trouble on one of his travels and ended up being a slave for a while, which kind of brought him low.
Yeah.
He ends up being like liberated from that at some point, goes back to England, and then becomes the captain of his own slave ship. And then actively participates in the slave trade as a captain of a slave ship for a number of years. At some point along the way, after committing untold crimes against humanity in the vein of what I described at the beginning of this episode, John Newton becomes a Christian, and he actually ends up becoming a priest. So he's the guy who wrote Amazing Grace, which is just, if you didn't know the backstory behind that, it's so profound to know that the guy who wrote this story about God's amazing grace is a guy who like probably killed like hundreds of slaves on his ship, and also was going blind towards the end of his life, which brings new meaning to the was blind but now I see line of that song. So anyway, Wilberforce comes to him and he's basically like, okay, I'm ready to follow Christ, but I don't know what to do about this whole Parliament gig.
Yeah.
Because I'm having a hard time seeing how I can like be a Christian and also be a member of Parliament, because he sees like some great evils that are being committed in his day. And John Newton is, as this old wise pastor speaking to this 27, 28 year old man, is basically pressing him on a good kind of theology of vocation. He's just like, you know what? He uses language from like the book of Esther. He's like, this is a kind of a for such a time as this moment for you. And he writes him this letter. I would recommend that you Google it, just John Newton's letter to Wilberforce. It's beautiful. It reads like a pastoral epistle right out of the New Testament. But there's this one line where he's really encouraging him to use his position for the glory of God. And he says, you are not only a representative for Yorkshire, you have the far greater honor of being a representative for the Lord in a place where many know him not, and an opportunity of showing them what are the genuine fruits of that religion which you are known to profess. And so Wilberforce is like, all right, I'm in. I'm going to stay in Parliament, but I'm gonna burn the candle on both ends, and I'm going to give it everything I got and use this power and my wealth to be an agent for change in my day. So Wilberforce has this mission statement of sorts that he establishes in 1787. He writes this famous line. He says, God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners, which sounds kind of weird.
It's kind of like keeping your elbows off the table.
Yeah, that stuff. Tucking in, you know, your napkin into your collar.
Yeah. I mean, I can see one being a little bit more important than the other. This more like a manners in following Christ if you profess him kind of way, or?
A little bit more like just the general morality of the society at large.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So when he's talking about this, he's really talking about the general betterment of society from a Christian worldview.
Yeah.
He's talking about cultural renewal. So at this time in England, just culturally, I mean, even in the elite were the ones who were, propelling this, you know, abomination of a slave trade. But even in the lower classes, things were really rough. So gin was extremely cheap at this time. And so I think almost everybody was like bound up in alcoholism, which has all sorts of societal effects. In the early 1700s, it's like a pretty well-established historical fact that 1 in 5 women in London were prostitutes.
Jeez.
Yeah.
1 in 20%. You got to think, like, 1 in 5 women being in the slave trade, or I'm sorry, in sex trade, and that much alcoholism. Just imagine the impact that's having on families and communities. That's a nightmare.
Today, we have an unprecedented amount of people who are kind of dabbling in the sex trade through things like OnlyFans.
Right.
And it's definitely not 1 in 5.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably like within the people that I know, I mean, it's probably like 1 in 100.
Yeah.
People I know are working in that field, and that's having a societal impact. So I can't imagine if we're talking 20%.
And prostitutes are, you know, a lot of times these women are kind of coerced into it. A lot of these are young girls. They're being subjected
This isn't because of some like sexual revolution that was going
on
in England.
They're not liberated. This is a depravity thing, but it's a depravity on all ends. This is bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he is working to kind of reform society at large, which is a massive task. In some ways, you think like maybe abolishing the slave trade is a little easier in a sense than like just changing how everybody thinks about everything, right? Mm-hmm. A commentator, historian named John Pollock said he set out to make goodness fashionable, and he succeeded. By the end of his life, Wilberforce had spent his entire fortune just working on these two projects.
Wow.
He saw a lot of progress in the Reformation of Manners category, which we'll talk some more about. The suppression of the slave trade project was not easy. Mm. It took him 20 years from when he kind of had this change of heart to when the slave trade was abolished, and then it's going to be another, like, I want to say it's like 30 years or something before, or 25 years before the slavery itself is just outlawed.
And he's an English dude, so this is the slave trade from Africa to England, right?
Yes, but this is what is so interesting about the slave trade. The slaves in, and I want to be careful here, the slaves who were in England, as far as I understand, were a lot better off than the slaves who were in the Americas.
Okay.
The slavery that we think of in America, the kind of chattel slavery, the torture, that stuff, that was all exported, and most people didn't even like know that this was going on. I mean, they knew that there was the slavery thing going on, but they didn't like know the kind of boots on the ground realities of what was going on. It was just kind of like they were living in their, you know, their shiny city, and everything's all gravy,
right? And I'm sure the tension between England and the colonies probably colored that perspective a little bit too, right? Where they probably thought like, oh well, we're definitely not handling things like the Americans are.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how the war plays into this, but at the end of the day, it was not going to be an easy task. The slave trade was an integral part of the British economy. Maybe a helpful way to think about it is think about how much money we spend on like defense in America, kind of our defense budget and all the money that's poured into every branch of our military, the weaponry development that we do. I mean, it really is a big driver of our economy. And to think about how like difficult that would sound to be like, yeah, I'm going to like dismantle all of that. Like, that's what I'm interested in dismantling. That's kind of like what he's up against here. There's a lot of money at play. And if we know anything, you start messing people's money.
Well, it's money, but it's also, these are people's jobs, you know?
Yep.
Like, it's dealing with jobs, it's industry, one of the big defenses against the slavery being abolished in the South was our agricultural system depends on this. Like, there's so many things hanging in the balance.
Yeah.
This is not a low risk change that he's trying to bring to society.
Yeah. There's this interesting kind of, it's not really a side piece, it's actually really integral to the story. But around this time, he develops this friend group that's known as the Clapham Circle or the Clapham Saints. Mm. The Clapham Saints was actually like a derogatory nickname that people gave them because they were all like either Methodists, or if they were in the Church of England, they were like devout, you know, Christians. And Clapham was this area that is now actually part of London, but it was a little bit outside of London at this time. And basically, it was this really cool group of people who were either they were like political elite, or they were poets or artists or thinkers, authors, who all gathered and lived kind of around this one like city block or in this one town square. They all went to church together at I think it was called Holy Trinity Clapham, and they really just dug in together on this common project of the abolition of slave trade and the betterment of society. And they, as a team, were working on this project. So William was kind of like the point man, but behind that, there's like, I don't know, there's like 15, 20 people that were part of this broader group
Brain trust,
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is the real secret behind the reformation of manners in English society. If you're interested in learning more about the Clapham Saints, look up folks like Granville Sharp, as well as Hannah Moore. And yeah, just some cool side stories there. So in 1788, that's the first time that William gets ready to submit a bill to Parliament for the abolition of the slave trade. And he works so hard on it that he actually gets ill. He just falls ill because he's just, like I said, burning the candle at both ends. And it doesn't pass. And he tries again and again and again and again and again over the course of 20 years, and it never passes. And there's some heartbreaking stories in there too of times where he got really close. Like, there was one time where he had actually figured out that he had enough support to get this thing to pass. And he, on the day where they were going to take the vote, his opponents basically got a bunch of opera tickets. And they go to the parliament members who they knew were in support, and they're like, hey, we got you some free tickets to go to that. I mean, this is the oldest trick in the book kind of
oldest,
crap.
Yeah. Seen it a million times. Yeah.
And so there was enough men who were more willing to go to the opera than to abolish the slave trade that they lost by 4 votes. Just heartbreaking.
Man.
Yeah.
I hope it was a darn good opera.
It probably wasn't. Oh, man. So, anyway, they find that they can't just, like, ramrod this through Parliament. It's just not, there's too much money tied up in it. These guys are bought and paid for by the lobbyists and the plantation owners. And, I mean, like I said, there's this massive economy behind this.
Yeah.
So, the Clapham Saints, they realize, okay, if we're going to actually change something here, we have to change public perception. Like, we need to really have, like, the general public consensus be this thing is wrong. Like, this is like a countrywide sin that we are engaging in, a national sin that needs to be dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way they do that is, like you said at the beginning of the podcast, like it just sits heavy, like the storytelling element of it. They start doing things like showing people like what it like taking people on a slave ship while it's at dock and being like, look at all this blood and like poop that's on the ground. Like, this is what people have to like, lay in for 100 days.
Mm-hmm.
There was a man named Equiano who was a freed slave from Africa who spent a lot of his time and energy just bringing public attention to this. Is what Equiano's work is really awesome. Look up Equiano as well. And then they also work through art. And so there was like this this coin that they had. I don't know if it was like a coin that could actually be used for like money or if it was more kind of like a challenge coin kind of thing that people carried around. But it was a coin that had like an image of a slave like kneeling down with his hands bound, and on it says, "Am I not a man and a brother?" And so this artwork, this storytelling, this poetry, this working to tell people like, hey, like, I know you like to eat sugar, but here's where it's coming from.
Yeah.
That really started to have an effect. So
it reminds me of, have you ever seen the movie Selma before?
I haven't seen Selma, no.
Yeah. So Selma's interesting. It is, I think it's a very good movie. So obviously it talks about the widespread protests and marches that were led by Martin Luther King during the civil rights movement. What I like about this one is while it still has the emotional punch of a lot of these types of films, it also gets into the strategy of what was happening.
Oh, yeah.
And this movie is interesting because Martin Luther King is very explicit. Like, we want to march through an area where they're going to fight us because we want America to see how they treat us when we try to stand up to our like for our rights and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And like that was a big part of America's kind of shifting position that led to the Civil Rights Act being passed was they saw the atrocity firsthand.
Yeah, that's important.
And that's so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, just getting stuff in front of the common person's eyes is just so critical, I think, in any sort of social change, abolition movement.
Yeah.
Yeah. So fast forwarding, this ultimately 20 years of work later results in the Slave Trade Act being passed on March 25th, 1807. And it's this beautiful moment in history where like public perception had changed so much that now the vast majority of the parliament members are ready to be behind this and they're excited to be behind it. There's kind of this like bitterness where it's almost like damn them for taking 20 years to figure that out, you know? But like eventually they do, and the vote is 283-16.
Wow.
It passes.
16 losers, am I right?
16 goons.
Yeah.
So It's so profound that they actually like take the vote again, and like they take the opportunity, they do a standing ovation for Wilberforce, who has just been beating his head against the wall, and like they've been treating him like crap for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And now they're like, okay, and like there's standing ovation, 3 cheers for Wilberforce, and he just like weeps in Parliament. Like he just has this like relief, like he finally got this project done.
Hmm.
Super cool moment. Unfortunately, it's not like the end of the problem.
Of course.
What they did was they made it the slave trade illegal. It still wasn't illegal to own slaves, and meanwhile these plantations are still rocking and rolling over in the Americas, and they're still going to be sending the sugar back in it. But I mean, they really dealt a blow to the industry. So there's kind of some hiccups that make the next step of just abolishing slavery in general take some time. One of those is the Napoleonic Wars kind of slow things down for a little bit. And then also Wilberforce has some personal tragedies that happen during this season that kind of just stall some of his work.
Mm-hmm.
In 1833, so how many years later is that?
26
years. That sounds right. 26 years later, we finally have the abolition of slavery, and Wilberforce has been just pouring himself out like a drink offering for like this whole season. He had some serious medical issues that he would take opium for, and he kind of developed an opium dependency during the season too, which is kind of a bummer. So he's just really struggling big time. His body's tore up from just pouring everything out, and he hears the news on his deathbed that Parliament is basically abolishing slavery in England and in the colonies. And 3 days later, he dies on the 29th of July, 1833.
Wow. He had nothing left.
Yep.
That was it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
Definitely a time in history where it's like, wow, like seems like God placed this person here for a very specific purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a it's really cool to see, cuz I'm not as familiar with the story of William Wilberforce as I am to like say the civil rights in relationship with slavery here stateside. It's really interesting to see how you can't, like, moving something on a government level is always going to be like iceberg slow. Like, you need to recognize that, like, the people are the ones, like, you need to shift those opinions over time. And I think that's what he recognized. And it's fascinating, just like the campaign that happened of like kind of showing off these atrocities to people who had just become either so desensitized or were just completely ignorant of what was happening.
Yeah. His work had an enormous effect on the what was going to come about 30 to 100 years later in America. Frederick Douglass, American abolitionist, Abraham Lincoln, both of these guys were deeply impacted and drew on Wilberforce's work to kind of fuel their fire over in America. I mean, just when we think about William, now we haven't really talked about the faith aspect of this too much yet, and the kind of how this plays into like church history, but just history in general.
Yeah.
Our boy Ryan one time said history in the West is church history.
Right.
Really love that.
Which is true.
Yeah.
Which is true.
But this is like so pivotal in Western history, but also just global history in general. Like,
well, I remember one of my favorite quotes from the late great Timothy Keller, and I don't even know if this is a quote as much as an idea, but he essentially said, human history has had slavery forever, as long as we could create slaves or oppose slaves, we did. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is not why do we have slaves, it's why would you ever get rid of them. And I think that, you know, that's the perfect bridge to talking about the faith element for William Wilberforce, because ultimately it's like, yeah, I mean, for us, it's fascinating because we're entering a culture that has such a weak stomach for anything that even looks like bigotry or prejudice, let alone slavery itself. But in this day and time, I mean, they're like, well, we can look back 100 years ago in our history and we had slaves in our country, and then we can look back to the people groups that formed this country and there was slavery, and then we can look back, you know, back as far as humanity goes and there's slavery. So why would we ever not have slaves? And the question really does come down to what William Wilberforce suggested and what they used to have on those coins, which was, is this black man, is this African not in fact also a brother of ours? Mm-hmm. That's a question that really does shake the framework of humanity. And we take it for granted now because of how far we've progressed. And I think the influence of Christianity on the humanism that is basically the modern day religion. But yeah, like these types of this idea that human beings have inherent value was not commonplace mm-hmm. for a long time. Like, we are very privileged to have that kind of consensus today, because back then it just wasn't.
Yeah. I think it's very telling that this was going on in a time in England's history where the state church was just hot garbage. Mm. I mean, there's just nothing vibrant or faithful going on there at all. So it doesn't surprise me that there's people who were just like a whole nation of people just patting themselves on the back that they were all good Christians, quote unquote. But meanwhile, they're just perpetuating this horrible slave trade. And also blind to all of the evils that were right in front of their doorstep. One mm-hmm. in five of their neighbors were prostitutes. Like, yeah. Unbelievable. So Wilberforce, I think it's really instructive for us to think, like, he definitely took some hits over his lifetime for being a Methodist and for being involved in this kind of, like, they viewed it as like this fanatical kind of Christianity. This was like a dork, basically.
Yeah.
And I mean, it really goes to show that because he was willing to do that, he was able to withstand some serious social pressure. One of my favorite things about Wilberforce, when we're thinking about, like, how did he pull this off? Like, he's kind of one of those people in history. It's like, how did he accomplish everything he did? How did he deal with the pressure, the death threats, the you know, the money, all of that? And there's this really sweet fact that we know about Wilberforce, where after the season where he was living at the Clapham, in the Clapham Circle, he moved really close to Parliament. He was within walking distance. And he had memorized the entirety of Psalm 119.
That's a long one.
Yeah. If you are unfamiliar with Psalm 119, find a Bible and go look it up, and then let your jaw drop when you imagine memorizing that whole thing.
Hmm.
He had figured out how to time it so he could leave Parliament or his house, doesn't matter which way he was going, and he would walk this certain path through a park on his way to and from, and he could recite the entirety of Psalm 119 on his way there. Psalm 119, its contents are exclusively about just valuing and treasuring God's word and his law and his commandments.
Yeah.
And to think of, like, I'm almost getting chills thinking about this. Like, that's the type of political leader I want in my country.
Yeah.
I want someone who has political power mm-hmm. that God has instituted and given authority to rule with a sword, to be a person who is so just immersing themselves in the reality that God's way is good.
Well, and that's, you know, we can kind of show our cards as two reformed dudes who buy into this Dutch idea of sphere sovereignty. Mm. Like, working for the objective human good is something that his life was committed to, and it's something that fits very well within our philosophy. Like, he wasn't trying to banish slavery and also institute a state mandated church. Like, he was not trying to you know, create a theocracy that out of which love for neighbor would flow. He recognized that as a government official, his responsibility was to seek that well-being for his community, and that's what he worked towards, and he allowed his Christian conscience to inform that, and that's what marked his life. And so, amazingly, like, someone with no religious affinity can look at him as a political figure and be like, wow, this man was tremendously effective. What was driving him? Oh, look, it was the love of Christ.
It was
Christ's ideal that humanity has inherent value that informed his political action.
Yeah. I think it's a very subtle but critical difference or thing to note that it is absolutely due to the effects of Christianity and Christians that the slave trade was abolished.
Yeah.
There's no way around that. Like, secular commentators look at this and like, this is because of Christians. Like, 100%. So Wilberforce, like, knew that this could not happen without the church, but his method was not, oh, we need to get this done, like, by the church, meaning he didn't like didn't seem that interested in like trying to reform the Church of England or fix anything there. He found his crew, he found the people that love Jesus. He's like, let's do this really hard thing together, and then they just like gave their lives up to do it.
Yeah. Which is, and while we can be so grateful to God that it was the conviction of spirit-led people that things like atrocities like slavery have lost their place in Western civilization, at least these forms of slavery, obviously we still struggle with things like human trafficking in this day and age, it's still worth lamenting just how much traction slavery received in Christian time periods. And I do think you mentioned earlier, like, the Church of England was in a terrible place at this time. Like, people would widespread, I mean, this was still an era where identity as a Christian was widespread throughout the West. So all of these people were probably either baptized or catechized in some way, and yet they were still just completely enslaved, ironically, to just a lot of cultural sins. And these weren't even cultural sins like just like pride or animosity. Like, these people were slaves to alcohol and to base sexuality in really devastating ways. Because, I mean, the thing about prostitution, like, there's obviously a lot of things wrong with it morally, but it's also just it's extremely unhealthy. It creates a high demand for abortions for women who are using their bodies like this. Like, there's so much manipulation, rape, sexual assault that happens. Like, this is just a den of everything wrong that could be happening. And it's a beautiful thing that someone who was moved by the Spirit of God was just like, look, guys, like, this is not what we're about.
Yeah.
Like, this is not what we're about. And yeah, I mean, we're grateful to God for this, dude.
Yeah.
You know,
I think one of our big takeaways that we should have today is to not go like, oh, wow, that's so cool that Wilberforce, you know, abolished the slave trade and everything's gravy now. Like, we should be asking God, what are the cultural sins of our day that we are just blind to?
Yeah.
That we need to have our eyes open to. And I'm sure there's things that we are, that even you and I are just blinded to, that God, we pray, will open our eyes to. But whenever we're talking about this topic, I can't help but think about some of the ways that we are really, our American culture, but not just American culture, this is kind of the effects of globalism. The whole world is benefiting from slave trade still.
Yeah.
There's slavery. Like, the lithium and cobalt in your phone probably came from a highly unethical source that maybe goes so far as just straight up manual slave labor in open pit mines that where there's no equipment being used other than the raw bleeding hands of men who are being forced to claw through this dirt in order to find the little minerals so that you can scroll Instagram today.
Yeah, not to mention just the effects of outsourcing to poverty-stricken countries where, yeah, because we talk about phones, but like textiles, clothes, like they're manufactured in sweatshops with child labor where people are being held in systems of severe, severe poverty. And companies are doing wonders for their capital bottom line by taking advantage of broken systems all around the world. That again, and I think an interesting correlation between my civil rights side note, the slave trade, the modern day exploitation of like global poverty, it's always unseen. Mm-hmm. There's always an element of it that it's like, it's not in my world. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there is something about even the church being universal. Like, we have our eyes open to the world around us. And I don't know what it looks like for something like that to grow. I don't know what it looks like to kind of like sound the alarm on this, but I think you're absolutely right. Like, this is a conversation that I don't really think we have a firm solution on how to solve, because just like with the slave trade that happened in the 1800s, there was so much writing on it, there was so much money behind it. This is a system that's very unlikely to be changed unless the Spirit of God gives us grace.
It's important to remember that you're not Wilberforce. You probably are not sitting in a position of political power in our country where you're able to institute change like he did. And so you shouldn't bear the weight of wanting to create change in our day as if you were carrying that power and responsibility. You should be willing to like talk about stuff. There's a lot of common people in this time who were just, maybe they were writing like the equivalent of like what we would call blog posts today, or maybe they were like, you know what, I'm not going to use sugar anymore. And then when someone asked them like, why didn't you have any sugar, they're able to talk about it. So for today, you know, that could be just a willingness to be aware of and talk about the reality that we are still benefiting from slavery massively today.
Yeah.
You don't need to wring your hands about, you know, how you are going to fix it, but contribute to the conversation.
Right. Yeah. The dialogue has to be alive, because like we said, just as there was that consistent element of something atrocious being unseen, what changed it was light.
Yep.
Was shining that light. And I don't know what that looks like. We're in such an age of like, there's such a saturation of information. It almost seems like, I almost get the sense that we're desensitized to true horror. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much that we can see. But I pray that we're not. I pray that our consciences are not so seared by the evil things around us that we're not too scarred to do something, because I hope we can do things still.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
We'll follow Christ and he'll show us the way.
Yeah, man. That's where I'll hang my hat. Well, hey dude, you put a lot of juice in this podcast, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah, man. It's if you're interested in learning more, and this is kind of where I kind of first got schooled in the Wilberforce stuff. Eric Metaxas wrote a really accessible biography of William Wilberforce, I think called Amazing Grace.
Okay.
It's really good. There's a documentary that you can watch on YouTube. It's about an hour long.
Mm.
But yeah.
This is not a full-on endorsement of everything Eric Metaxas does, though.
I really like his biographies.
I you know what? I read, like, a good amount of his Bonhoeffer biography, and I was surprised that people had such an issue with it.
I don't have the same like beef with Metaxas as others do. I can't believe we're talking about Metaxas right now.
Yeah. But, sorry, yeah. Man. Maybe we'll have this part edited out.
The Wilberforce biography is great. I can fully endorse it.
All right. See, and I stand behind that. Because you know what? If you endorse it, I endorse it too, man.
That's
That's what podcast brothers man. Do. That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for listening. We hope that you found this this story inspiring. And As always, we appreciate you being here to have this conversation with us, and we will catch you next time.
God bless you.